Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and joining me is the woman who is a mystery unto herself. It's Lydia.
I thought you were going to say something about being as frigid as a winter river or something.
That's too much of a deep cut.
Okay. Maybe also slightly untrue. But, you know, but timely. It's thematic.
Yeah, that's true. It definitely would have fit the theme of the film. Well, before we go any further, I want to thank everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts and wherever you choose to listen. If you have the option to rate and review the show, please do so. That does help get the show in front of more eyes and hopefully in more ears. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we've covered here on the show. And if you would like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. We did get a brief comment on the Discord channel, speaking of the social media sites. User Caterberg, K-A-T-E-R-B-E-R-G, Caterberg or Caterberg? I always think Caterberg, but I guess it could be Caterberg.
Definitely one of the two.
Anyway, they just came out on Discord and mentioned that they don't think we should worry about spoilers for the show. I can't imagine people are going to listen before watching. And even if they did, having the first half spoiled and saving the last bit seems like it doesn't protect much. Being able to hear the two of your thoughts on things like the giant gorilla from Africa Screams would have been interesting.
Well, gosh, now I feel like we should put that out as a poll and let you guys decide.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, please come to all the social medias or send us an email. Let us know if you care about if we spoil the films.
And it isn't as if these are new releases.
No, I mean, we are dealing with movies that are nearly 100 years old in some cases.
In many cases, yeah.
But on that same token, you know, kind of flip the coin, these films are really old and maybe not in people's, they're not in their watch list. Mm-hmm. So that's where I kind of fall. It's like, well, these are films that maybe people haven't even heard of, so... But then, of course, if they haven't heard of it, why are they listening to the show about it? So.
Are you kidding? We're a worldwide smash. People just stumble across us constantly.
Yeah, I feel like we're kind of in a catch-22 when it comes to our audience and the films we cover.
A little bit. They're still fun to talk about. Yeah. They're fun to discover. Oh. Rediscover, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. They did go on and say that they keep the released episodes in their podcatcher, and it's a great incentive for me to watch the film since I have the episode as a constant reminder to watch it.
Oh, nice. So I like that. I think part of it is I sometimes think maybe people listen to the podcast before they decide if they'll spend time on the movie, but that does seem very backwards to me. That's definitely not how I would do it if I were, you know, following anything besides Orphan Entertainment. I would think I would probably jump right on watching, making sure I'd seen the movie before.
I've done both, but more often than not, I've listened to a podcast, heard all about the movie, and then went, I've got to see this for myself.
You know, now that you've said that, I've definitely had that experience with a couple of other podcasts I've run across that have referenced books or movies, and I've then gone, oh, now I really need to look that up. So that's a valid point. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm really interested to know then what our reader base, it's almost bedtime. I'm really interested to know what our listener base thinks about that as a group, because I think that's an interesting viewpoint. And definitely, again, we're not covering anything new. So I think the thing is, like, for new listeners, there's a huge potential for spoilers, but for existing listeners, which definitely make up the majority of our listener base, of course, there's not that risk. So yeah, so I'm interested to know what you guys think.
Yeah, very. It'd be very interesting to hear from a few other people on that subject, because I definitely have listened to shows and have had the entire movie spoiled, but I still seek out the film to watch it for myself, even though I know what's coming up. in the film. They'll the big twist ending, and they'll tell me, and they're like, "Oh, that's crazy! I've got to see that."
Valid, yeah, that's definitely true. That's interesting. Or, you know, you get to a point where you figure out, okay, at some point you're gonna just shut off the podcast once you know. You guys may not know this about me. I'm about to share some personal information here. Super personal, top secret. I don't watch trailers. I especially don't watch trailers if I, within the first 10 seconds of the trailer, know I want to watch the movie. I can't think of the last time that actually happened. There haven't been a whole lot of new movies coming out that have caught my attention lately. Not because I'm pedantic in what I like to watch. I just feel like a lot of the subject matter has been, unfortunately, seems like a lot of what's been coming out that's been really catching my attention has been independently produced or by streaming services. But when we do go to movies, if something pops up, and especially if it's something that I know pretty quickly I'm going to want to watch, I just cover my eyes, cover my ears, close my eyes, cover my head, hide under the seat, hum loudly, annoy everybody around me. No, that's not true. But I think since probably about 2008, I've gone really far out of my way to avoid seeing trailers. A great example, I never saw the trailer for Prometheus. And so if that movie hadn't been spoiled by the brilliant employee of the movie theater that stood up at the front of the whole thing and told everybody, hey guys, guess what? Insert spoiler here that now, of course, everybody knows. But at the time, I didn't know. Both my brother and I had worked really hard not to watch those trailers. God. Like, went way out of our way. Anyway, so I don't watch trailers, so I don't really know what's coming up. How did I get on that tangent?
Well, as far as trailers go for me, I usually watch like a trailer, like when the first teaser trailer or something like that comes out, yeah. I will watch that. And if that has got my interest in seeing the film, I will try to avoid any further trailers or spoilers going forward.
But tell me, within watching, let's say the first, especially since trailers at this point are nothing but spoilers, which is my strong argument against them at this time.
True.
But they put all the funniest stuff in there, and then you watch the movie and go, oh yeah, I remember that from the trailer, and the movie's completely spoiled. But if within the first 10 seconds of a trailer, you typically know if it's a movie you probably are going to want to see, right?
Maybe.
I would say within the first 10 or 15 seconds of any trailer, I can tell you this is something I'm already excited about seeing, or it's something that I'm going to wait for it to go to VHS. That was a joke. But
here at Orphan Entertainment, that may not be.
It may not. I wanted to show up on my 35 millimeter. But my whole point to that, I remembered what it was, yeah, you could definitely stumble across this podcast, hear what we're talking about. But if you don't figure out within the first, let's say, 5 minutes of the meat of this podcast, if you want to watch this movie that we're talking about or not, we're not doing our jobs very well. So I think probably that's the thing. There's all that to circle. See, this is why we love when you guys do any kind of comment or letter, because it gives us so much interesting stuff to talk about. I mean, aside from the movies, of course.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we will maybe be a little less judicious in avoiding spoilers in the future, especially when it comes to something, as they mentioned, Africa Screams, where, talking about the end of that film.
Yeah, we could probably be less worried about it, more like on the Rain end, where we don't want to spoil it, but then if we're talking Africa Screams or, gosh, any of the... I think any of a few of the past ones. This one will be interesting to see if we would want to talk about the end of it or not, because this is part of a serial. And it's not a terribly unconventional storyline. Now, this is probably... I'm jumping way ahead. We should probably get back on the rails.
Yeah, probably. But I would like to just... I don't think it's really part of a serial... But it is part of like a series of films with the same character.
And books.
Oh, yeah, of course. And obviously based on the books, which we will get into here in a little bit. So, yeah, you're right. So that we'll probably talk about that a little bit more and get a little further into that. Just real quick, I did also want to mention that I got an email from a Brett Piper, who was good enough to let me know that they started listening with Midnight Manhunt. Not the strongest of film, but a fun episode. And they were really enjoying the show. They listened to Africa Screams, and it made them want to go back and hear our take on Road to Bali. Okay. And they let me know that the Road to Bali episode, the link was broken and the audio wasn't there. So thank you for letting me know. Yeah, because, yes, I did have to shuffle some files around, kind of making room on the server and that sort of thing. And that one got missed. So I'm glad you let me know. And that has been corrected. I let them know that that had been corrected. And they did go back and listen to it and thought that was a really good time. So thank you very much, Britt, for letting us know about that.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and Road to Bali was a fun one. That was with all three of us. Barry was with us on that one, so I'm sure that was a really fun listen.
We had a movie poster for that with our faces on it.
We did.
Where did you post that?
I posted it. I wonder if I used that for the episode. I know I posted it on the social media. I posted it on Facebook. I may have used it to when I posted the episode, but I can't swear by it.
Okay.
All right. Well, with that, let's go ahead and listen to an Ellery Queen 1 minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we find out that it isn't easy being a Green when we discuss the Green murder case.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Curious Gangland Killing. When a small-time gangster named Lopez was found dead at the bottom of the river, police immediately assumed it was a gangland killing. Lopez was found tied tightly with cotton rope. His legs were bound together with heavy irons. Open and shut case, said the police. But I investigated and found out Lopez had a lot of insurance, and he was suffering from an incurable disease. This wasn't a gangland killing, I insisted, but a case of suicide. The police didn't believe me till I showed them why. In a moment, I'll explain.
The Flash Pulp Podcast. 3 to 10 minutes of fiction brought to you thrice weekly. Now it's 3 apocalypses in one.
Yeah!
Suffering from tough, stuck-on humans? Well, 20 hellish hours of suffocation in the all-encompassing web of Karwick the Spider God will get them right out. Too many brains lying around? The ravenous mouths surrounding zombie-fighting Ruby will quickly clean those up. Nosy neighbors, infect them with the murder plague, and watch as they dissolve into paranoid maniacs bent on the preemptive assassination of their friends and family. Why stop at one end of the world when you can have all three? You can find them all at flashpulp.com, or search for them on iTunes.
In the case of the curious gangland killing, you recall Lopez was tied tightly with cotton rope. Actually, he tied himself up loosely and the cotton rope tightened in the water. By appearing to have been killed, his wife would collect double indemnity, and she almost did. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
The Green Murder Case was released in 1929 and is based on the novel of the same name from Arthur S.S. Van Dyne, which was published the year before. It stars William Powell as Philo Vance, who is taken on the job of helping the police solve a murder and an attempted murder at the Green Mansion. The Greens are a family forced to live together due to the terms of the late patriarch's will. The siblings, one of whom is adopted, and the invalid bedridden mother exist in the home and appear to pass their day by spitting venom at one another. One of the sons is shot to death and a daughter injured when she is shot in the back. Mysterious footprints in the snow are the only thing out of place. How can Philo Vance whittle down the suspects when no one has an alibi and everyone has a motive? Now, we have talked about William Powell before, and I think we both suggest watching any and everything he has done.
So. Yes, let's talk about William Powell again.
So I do want to fill everyone in a little bit about the character of Philo Vance and his creator. Philo Vance appeared in 12 crime novels written by S.S. Van Dyne, the pen name of Willard Huntington Wright, in the 1920s and 1930s. Vance was described in the novels as being extremely well-cultured and intelligent, while being somewhat of a foppish dandy. So, William Powell.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'd go with fop, but definitely well-mannered and cultured.
True. Okay, yes. His physical appearance was described in the first novel, The Benson Murder Case, as unusually good-looking. There was a slightly derisive hauteur in the lift of his eyebrows. I might not be saying that right either.
No, that sounds right to me.
His forehead was full and sloping. It was the artist's rather than a scholar's brow. His cold gray eyes were widely spaced. His nose was straight and slender, and his chin narrow but prominent, with an unusually deep cleft. Vance was slightly under 6 feet, graceful, and given the impression of sinewy strength and nervous endurance.
I have so many thoughts right now, but none of them are leading to William Powell.
And in the Canary murder case, he was described as to be not yet 35.
Well, that's just straight out of an Austen novel, isn't it?
Yes. Philo Vance was a skilled fencer, golfer, a breeder of show dogs, a polo player, a poker player, an archer, a fan of classical music, knowledgeable at chess, and a connoisseur of fine food and drink, as well as able to speak multiple foreign languages, just to name a few of his abilities.
So he's a rich genius. Because at my age, which is not yet 35, which is well past 35, who has the time? Oh, you know what? Philo Vance didn't have TV or movies.
That's true. No, it definitely...
He was created in the 1890s, wasn't he?
Yeah, 1920s, 1930s.
Oh, I thought the books were earlier than that.
No.
Oh.
It does sound like he has whatever the plot needs him to have as far as skills and knowledge.
I think that happens.
S.S. Van Dyne, while his novels were lauded at the time, dismissed the idea that they should be considered as serious literature. He felt that the detective novel should be an intellectual pulp that should follow strict rules and not wander too far afield. He followed this idea in all his Philo Vance novels, which led to many critics to find them formulaic and to quickly feel dated. Most of the stories took place within Manhattan, with only brief excursions to other surrounding neighborhoods, with the exception of the last novel, The Winter Murder Case, which traveled to Massachusetts. The author only just finished this novel before he died unexpectedly in April of 1939. The character Philo Vance appeared on the radio, as well as 15 films played by various actors. Other actors to play the part on film are Basil Rathbone, Warren William, Wilfred Hyde White, and Alan Curtis, while Jose Ferrer voiced the role for a radio drama series beginning in 1945, and in 1946, John Emery took over, and then in 1948, Jackson Beck. There was even an Italian television miniseries produced starring Giorgio Albertazzi, and it was 3 episodes based on the first 3 novels and were reportedly very faithful to the books. And I'll just point out that we have seen Jean Arthur, who also stars in this film, a couple times, once in 1930's The Silver Horde in July of 2023, and in Danger Lights in October of that same year. And I do have another little factoid about the character as far as what William Powell thought of the character, but I think I might try to save that till later in the discussion.
Yeah.
Because I just think that may come up.
Okay. the other actor that jumped out at me on this one was Eugene Pallett, who is, I always think of him as Horace from The Lady Eve, which is, you guys will hear me mention it again and again. It's just one of the best movies ever out there. But he's got this, he plays the Sergeant Heath, mm-hmm. the detective, the actual police detective, sergeant, I guess it is. And he's so iconic. His voice and his appearance are, to me, so iconic. I've never run across anybody else in any movie that reminds me of him. He's just as him. There are a few actors out there that are like that. You just never kind of catch that feeling again. I just think he's so fun to watch. He's understated and gruff, and that's what his character always is. He is always himself, but I really enjoy him. So it's fun to see him again in yet another movie, because if you've seen him at all, you've seen him in probably multiple things.
Yes, he definitely seemed familiar. If if I haven't seen him, I've seen other actors playing the same sort of police detective.
We've also seen him in My Man Godfrey, also with William Powell.
Oh, very interesting.
But he has, his voice is, I think, is as distinctive as somebody like Benedict Cumberbatch. You just, when you hear him, you know it's him. And so it's, anytime I'm watching something and hear his voice, I immediately, you know, realign to, oh, it's him. Couldn't tell you his name 99% of the time, but oh, it's him. And I know he did a couple Shirley Temple movies. I'm pretty sure he did a couple Shirley Temple movies. I said that really confidently and then I had to backpedal. But he just was around for so long and did so many, not main parts. He was in over 250 movies, but everything that he's in, including Lake Placid, Serenade, not the same as Lake Placid, but yeah, he's fun to look out for, and I recommend. I've never seen him in a movie. I can't think of a movie he's been in that I didn't like, which is kind of, especially considering he's not usually the main character. That's kind of an interesting comment, I think.
Yeah, just a character actor of the time, I suppose you would say.
But it seems like he got very lucky or he picked good movies.
Yeah, probably got very lucky because I think this is certainly back in the day of the studio
contracts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you work for the studio and they say we need you to do this part of, you know, be on set at 9 tomorrow morning kind of thing. So,
mm-hmm.
They obviously saw that he had a type, I guess, that he fits.
Yeah, definitely.
And then he did, and he fit those parts well. I get a kick right from the beginning of the film. We've got the police that are like befuddled with the case, and just so happens that Philo Vance calls, and wasn't even the chief. It was I guess he was the commissioner. Ooh. Who just hands the phone like, well, do you want to talk to him? to the sergeant.
Yes, the newspapers had it right. Chester Green was killed instantly, but the girl was only wounded. Of course it was attempted robbery. Why, the silverware alone was... Just a moment. Philo Vance.
What's the matter? Somebody been bumped off?
Or is this Green business?
Oh, that job.
It's the first case in which Vance has shown any interest since the Canary murder.
That's right.
You see, he doesn't go for your burglar theory.
He don't, eh?
No.
Well,
You want to talk to him?
Sure. Hello, Mr. Vance. This is Sergeant Heath talking.
Oh, good morning, Sergeant.
Say, what's wrong with the burglar theory in that Green case?
Well, nothing, Sergeant. Except, doesn't it strike you as rather odd that a burglar should dally about in the hall for 3 minutes between the two shots?
Why, no, he just, Say, Mr. Vance, maybe you could,
Thank you, Sergeant. I'll be ready in half an hour.
He'll be ready in half an hour.
Thank you, Sergeant.
Well, that's all right.
I love these early films where there's the detective that the police are just willing to just immediately hand the case over to.
Mm-hmm.
That is not something that you see at another 10 or 15 years from now. Where the police are supposed to be the good guys and the detectives are always the ones getting in the way.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that Sherlock Holmes kind of, I guess, initiated by Sherlock Holmes, where eventually Scotland Yard just was like, oh yeah, Holmes wants in on it, he's going to know the answer.
It reminds me, I bring this up because I've just recently just kind of started watching occasionally the old 1960s Batman.
Oh yeah.
So anytime the crime comes up, the commissioner and Chief O'Hara just, well, there's only one thing we can do.
Right.
Immediately pick up the phone.
Yeah, I found it interesting that in this story, Philo Vance calls them about it. He says, oh yeah, I was reading about this murder case and I'm kind of curious what you guys are coming up with. And essentially, I think he immediately pegs it that the police are going to get this wrong.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. He's the one that actually calls them. And there's a little bit, You know, you did mention that this is kind of a serial, and in a way it kind of does, because I think the police do even say, well, we haven't heard anything from him since the Canary murder case, which was the previous film.
One of the daughters, I think, says, oh, yeah, we read all about you in that Canary murder case.
Yeah, it's mentioned at least twice in this film.
Yeah, which is interesting because that one also starred William Powell.
Mm-hmm.
He did 5 File of Vance movies.
Correct.
But we're coming in on the second one.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, I'm not sure how that worked, but.
Well, it's based on I hate to use this word this early in this podcast, but based on the formulaic genre that we're experiencing in this film, I'm going to drop my voice and become very radio BBC. Yeah, not a lot of surprises in this one. Actually, though, now that I've said that, we should continue with the plot so that we can discuss whether there are surprises or not. There aren't surprises in the formula.
Okay, well, you know, we got William Powell, Philo Vance, calls the police. The police kind of ask without asking for him to look into it and then just follow him around like a little puppy dog as he interviews all the suspects and everything. And I guess the film actually doesn't the film actually open with the will, or not the will reading, but the lawyer double checking to making sure everyone is still living by the will's
requirements.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. That's how I perceived it as well.
Well, each year finds you better, Mrs. Green.
It does not. Nurse, some say that I come here.
Hello, Mr. Cannon. Well, fire away, Cannon.
Chester! See, what do I matter? A paralyzed old woman like me? Ada's the only comfort of all these ungrateful children. And she only pretends to love me.
Miss Sabella.
Elliot.
Mr. Lex. Good evening.
What's good about it?
Or any other evening in this house.
I must say, 10 years of these meetings have made me dislike being a policeman as much as you dislike each other. But as you know, your father's will requires me to determine every year whether you have lived according to the provisions thereof. And to remind you that you must live in this house and maintain this property intact for 15 years after your father's and husband's death. That's 5 years more, or be disinherited. And that on this date, 1934, if you have carried out this provision, the estate will be divided equally between you, or in the event of death, between any of you who are still alive.
Have you got a match?
Remembering, of course, the bequest to the servants who have been with you since the death of Mr. Green.
Sabella, put that out.
And the exception that Miss Ada, not being of the family blood, may live elsewhere if she marries. Now, Mrs. Green, you haven't left the house.
Use your head, you fool. How could I? Haven't I?
Been lying here for 10 years, making life miserable for everybody, including myself.
No, shut up. See? Well, Chester?
Still here.
Miss Sabella.
In prison. Sabella, where are you going?
To the theater, little buttercup.
With Arthur.
Yes, darling.
You're after Arthur yourself now, eh?
Stop it.
Mr. Rex?
Why, certainly I've been here.
Thank you.
And going crazy in the middle of this loving family.
Miss Ada? Miss Ada?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, that's everybody. Thank you. Good evening.
Immediately, we get a lot of characters where we only get to see them briefly in this scene, and then everyone starts getting picked off rather quickly soon thereafter, and I find that to be a little bit of a shame. I kind of wanted to spend more time in the greenhouse watching these people shoot daggers at each other with their eyes.
It definitely, I didn't catch all of the characters the first go around. The second time I watched it, I was like, oh, that's who that person was. Yeah, I agree with you on that. There's such a quick introduction, and I think they say everybody's names in kind of a round the room. You stop smoking. You stand up straight. You stop biting your fingernails or whatever it is. And, of course, mother in the bed, bedridden and grumpy. And But it's so fast, and then you, and then throughout the movie, you get flashes of other people. You get the German cook and the hyper-religious maid or housekeeper, whatever she is, the young and innocent maid, and I, and it just goes also. And there's a doctor somewhere thrown in there, and I don't know if there's a priest.
There is a sprout.
A sprout? I don't even know what a sprout is.
The butler. The butler's name is Sprout.
The butler, that was the one I was missing. And there's a small dog as well.
Yeah.
But it, you're right. There are, this is a, what, 60-minute movie? 61 or 62 minutes. And you, there are so many speaking parts, not just characters, but speaking parts in this, that it actually, it goes at a pretty quick clip. This is not a movie that, I didn't feel like at any point I was, it was dragging. I didn't feel like it dragged at all.
No, it moves along pretty well. I mean, we get our first murder within the first, what, maybe 5-10 minutes of the film?
Mm-hmm. I would say first 5, most likely.
Yes, and an attempted murder, all within a few seconds of each other. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a film that pretty much hits the ground running and then doesn't stop until the end.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You are always one to kind of notice what they're wearing. Now, while this one isn't really a period piece because it was taking place, you know, in the time in which it was set, it was something I just noticed. And maybe it's just the guy in me, Sybilla Green, the one of the daughters of the family. As soon as they're done with, you know, the official stuff, she's going to head out on the town. She was wearing a very... How to put this without making me sound? She was wearing a very, frankly, a very sexy top.
I didn't notice that. I did notice the evening dress that she's wearing. It's a mid-calf, and it's got a lot of chiffon and sparklies on it. And it reminded me so much of the dress that Kathy Seldon wears in Singin' in the Rain when they do the whole You Were Meant for Me song. Anybody that knows the movie is going to be like, oh, yeah, that one. Actually, she's wearing the same one. It's the costume from the Beautiful Girls song, but she just carries it over to the soundstage when Gene Kelly sings to her. But the style is like... spot on, and that movie was, I'm really bad with my movie dates, but at least 10 years after this, 15 years after this, and so they are throwing back to this time period in that movie. Of course, Singin' in the Rain is all about the silent films going to talkies.
Sure.
And so this is right in that period. So I won't say that I noticed all of the costuming. It was very dark in places. This movie is hard to see in spots, and there's some interesting cinematography, some long shots that look extremely fake, and I still am not sure if they are extremely fake or if they, I don't know how they did them, but there's some difficulty with the costuming just from the standpoint of it's really hard to see at points. Mm.
Well, this one,
the men are all in suits.
Yeah, this one I noticed it was just it was very typical of the time, but it was... open on the sides, very loose fitting, open on the sides. And it's just, it was one of those outfits where, you know, if she would move or turn wrong, you would get a full view is all what I'm saying.
I feel like a lot of that is down to the black and white. And a lot of it is down to, you're saying she's wearing a dress real similar to what you see, Nora wearing in the Thin Man series. It's basically like two handkerchiefs and a spaghetti straps, I think is what you're talking about.
A little bit. Yeah, I think that must be it.
Okay. Yeah, and that's what they wore. That was what wealthy people wore in the time period, assuming they had the figure for it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And she is very much a 1920s waify flapper girl style body. And she's got this, it's just something because at one point she gets up and you see her from the side. And it like I said, it's open on the sides and it's very loose in the front. And I just, That's a rather risque top.
It is. She is wearing, well, an interesting thing about historical clothing, seems like the later it gets in the evening, the more risque women's clothes become. Gee, I wonder why that happens. It's almost like there are designers designing things to become more and more risque the later it gets at night. It's almost like it's intentionally done by some designers out there that are mostly, let's face it, at this period of time, mostly male. So interesting. I actually, you know, it's funny that that is not the dress that I noticed, probably because it's not the dress that I would wear. But you are not mistaken. It is there are actually tops around nowadays that are a lot like that are pretty popular, and I still can't wear them.
And I think maybe one of the reasons it stood out is because it seemed very inappropriate for going out on a winter night.
No, that is completely true. There are a couple of things that happen in this winter setting, like opening windows.
Yes.
That seem a bit, let's just say not what I would have chosen.
No. Would you have gone with something more like Jean Arthur was wearing as Ada Green? She was supposedly the more... And I wonder if it was... they did this on purpose because they were trying to, like, separate the two daughters. You know, one's 100%. The one, the wild girl. The one is the prim and proper and no inner place, you know, takes care of mother, daughter.
Definitely. They even mention in the script that Ada has like a kind of Cinderella life going on. So, and I'm going to get her name wrong because it's hard to pronounce, but I'm going to try all the same.
Sabella.
Thank you. I spaced it for a second. Sabella, which is an interesting name. I wonder where it came from, but fascinating name. Sabella is obviously the favored daughter. And they go, you're right, it is a costuming choice. They go out of their way to point out that Sabella wears anything she wants. She's got furs, she's got a little dog. She's, she runs around at night wherever she wants to. She talks down to anybody she wants to. She's very sarcastic and snooty. And then you've got Ada, who is, you're exactly right, supposed to be the withdrawn and quiet. So she's, the difference isn't that she's not wearing, I'm going to use the word slutty clothes. It's not that she's not wearing slutty clothes. It's that she's not dressed for going out.
Right.
So she's expected to stay home and read to mother. To mother, I just had psycho flashbacks. Mother doesn't like it. but she's expected to stay home, and she knows that's expected of her, so she doesn't even bother putting on her dress and saying, hey, can I go to the ball? She's just going to be stuck here at home with mom. But it is a costume choice.
Mom is not someone I would want to have to sit around and take care of either. She is a mean old bat.
Really? You're just not excited to talk to people, like sit around and talk to people that just nitpick all the time and hate you?
Nitpick, and she has no love for any of her children. Even Ada, who has doted on her, and she just she looks at her and is like, Ada's the only one that cares, and she just pretends. Jeez.
It seems legit, you know. No children love their parents, right? I'm being sarcastic. No, she's I guess you could make a really strong argument for she's been bedridden for over a decade with some kind of, you know, degenerative disease or whatever, or injury. But yeah, that's not really a good excuse.
Yeah, so we do get our murder. Everyone is, then Philo Vance comes on the scene and starts investigating and interviewing and everything. You know, it's interesting. Philo Vance, I feel like he goes and he questions and he just sort of wanders through the house. And things happen and you're kind of... There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of detectiving going on until the very end of the film.
Yeah, I feel like there's a line early on where he says, I have an idea, but I want to think about it before I bring it up. And so I feel, and I could have that wrong, but I feel like that happens pretty early, not on the phone call, but almost immediately after the phone call, like as soon as they pretty much, you're introduced to him. And so it's not so much like he's detecting as he's like gathering support for his already existing idea throughout the movie.
Yeah, perhaps. But all these things seem to come to him. I swear, it's almost like he just sits in the center of the house and everyone comes to him with their little theories or their stories or the events happen. And he sits there and just,
Well, it works for Poirot. you're not mistaken, but I got the impression, since he's with the sergeant, that the sergeant is saying, hey, bring in these people. I want to talk to them. Bring in these people. I want to talk to them.
Right.
And I feel like early on, so you get Chester is the brother who is killed right.
Correct.
In the very, very beginning.
Yes.
And then, Ada, of course, is the one who is attempted to be killed but isn't killed. And because, of course, it's always the sweet ones, right? And then they walk around and they ask, like, kind of what's going on, but then they all kind of leave, don't they? And then they come back when something, and then they end up in a phone conversation in which they hear an additional murder, and then they come back to the house. It's a little bit funny.
It is a little bit, and some time jumps as well, where the story is just, well, we've had Detective Case in the place for a week now. Oh, all right.
Yeah, like they're definitely trying to get, they want to move the story along, but they don't want to show, like, I don't know. I did pick up the book. I did pick up the book, by the way.
As did I. I haven't opened it yet.
Oh, okay. Well, I started perusing it. It's available on archive.org, by the way. And as I was perusing it, the thing that really jumped out to me the most was that it's written like a book from this time period. It's very verbose and kind of has a lot of flowery language. I would almost say it's like a pretentious, it's kind of pretentious, but it does seem like the beginning of the movie follows the beginning of the book. So I'm guessing that the rest of the movie also follows the rest of the book, but that's an assumption. So I'm kind of curious to know if that's the case or not. It does. It jumps around a bit, and it feels like it follows a logic, but it also, we're running into the same case with this movie that we've seen with a few others, where they're not giving you enough time to get invested in the character before they kill him off.
Yes.
And so you're even like, some of the actors are so much fun to watch. Jean Arthur, of course, is a delight in everything that we've seen her in. And she works, I think she does a lot with what little they give her in this movie. But yeah, we don't get the ability to get attached to anybody, not even Philo Vance. So this is where I come back around to, should we have watched the Canary murder first? Did it give better background?
Mm-hmm.
Would that have drawn us into the character so that we would have been excited to see it again and say, oh yeah, this is a thing that happened in the last movie. So that was kind of fun to see happen again. In this movie, the closest we get to that is when the younger brother, Rex, I think, is having kind of a breakdown on screen, and he like, oh, and like, and he's like, I'm not going to leave. You're not going to let me leave. You're all going to just wait till I get murdered or whatever. And he right. storms out. And then the sergeant turns and looks at Philo and goes, do you like this family? And Philo didn't say anything. It's just like, it just leaves it hanging out there. It actually made me laugh when that happened, but that's kind of it. Like that's as much emotional as much as we get emotionally drawn into the story at all.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I do. You mentioned Jean Arthur is Ada. She, I think, is really good, and you don't realize how good she is until you get to the end of the film, and you actually kind of go back when you watch it a second time. You can pick on some things that she does subtly, or she does things that are really subtle that you don't know why she does them, or you don't even notice that they're done, but they are done for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where she, you know, she says that on the phone, she tells her brother, like, well, I wrote this word down. I heard someone say this word, and I think it's important, but I don't remember what it is. I wrote it down, and I put it in our secret mailbox.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes to go get it, and is murdered over the phone. Later on, when they go back to the house, Philo Vance says, well, you mentioned that you put the note in your secret mailbox. Could you show me where that is? She steps into the room and she takes like a half second where you see her just sort of just glance around, and then she picks, oh, it was this incense burner. We used to put things inside.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you find out later that that's not where the secret mailbox was. So, mm-hmm. yes, yeah, she, the character, Ada, has to walk into that room and then think fast on her feet to find something to call. And like, you wouldn't notice that right off the bat, but it's there. And I thought, okay, there are some bits of this film that are way more clever than I thought. If when you go back and watch it a second time.
Yeah. I think that's in here. And again, I think the big thing that I don't think it's missing for cleverness. And I don't think that the murder case itself is not well thought out. I actually think it's very well thought out. I may not subscribe to all of the logic behind why it is what it is. Like anytime you say this person has crazy people in their lineage and therefore they're also a crazy person, it hangs up a little bit for me there.
Yeah.
But honestly, I would buy this case, this story. I would believe it for different reasons. And it's thought out really well. And you definitely get the idea that the person that's perpetrating all this is actually very intelligent.
Yes, absolutely. It does do that thing where, it takes me back to like Murder by Death, where Lionel Twain is complaining about how, you withheld information or you.
Yeah.
You reveal something that the readers didn't know that would have helped them solve the crime. And that sort of stuff happens in this, where Philo Vance makes a phone call and he has information from this phone call. And that turns out to be all about Ada's actual father and her mother. And like, well, that would have been helpful.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that they set her up from the beginning as being one of the daughters of the household. And then, but obviously being treated very differently. And then, they wait till the very end to kind of drop that bomb on you.
Before we go much further here, I want to go ahead and tell you what I read that William Powell thought of the Philo Vance character.
Okay, I'm very interested to hear.
He actually really didn't care for playing the detective, despite doing so for 4 times in the Philo Vance films, and I don't know if his views changed by the time he did The Thin Man or not, but this is what he had to say of Philo Vance. The opportunities of a detective on the screen are too limited. What is his main function? To solve the crime. And how does he do it? By thinking. So we have him stand up and thinking, sitting down and thinking, lying down and thinking, ad nauseum. He is practically the only member of the cast without a chance for dramatic action or outstanding characterization. The interest revolves about him, true enough, but he is like a rock in the center of a whirlpool. He doesn't have a chance to act.
That's interesting.
It was very interesting. I was very interested in reading that after I had watched the film, and I was thinking the same thing, is he really just sort of meanders through the film while everyone else does everything. And he sits there and just balls it all over in his head.
It's very interesting. So I was going to kind of hang on to this opinion until the end. But now that you've brought it up, I think he did 5 of these. I think he played Philo Vance 5 times, all before the first Thin Man the first Thin Man movie in 1934. I would have referred to this as the less interesting Thin Man.
Yeah.
But you know what the Thin Man has that this doesn't?
Myrna Loy.
and her whole role in the series as his, not only as his wife, but as the comic relief and as it, like she does so much in the story to keep pushing things forward or to keep things interesting when, like he says in this quote, the only thing the detective can do is sit around and think. And so she allows there to be, her character, Nora, allows there to be other things going on outside of the case. And so it strips away all of that narrow focus, and it stops all of the interesting people from having to be involved in the case. Now, Agatha Christie suffers from that same thing, right? If you're watching Poirot or you're watching Miss Marple, anything like that, all the interesting stuff is happening inside of the people involved in the case. with the Thin Man series, all the interesting stuff is happening outside the case. It's all happening between the two of them, all the comedy and all the interest. And, you know, often they get dragged into the thing, into the mysteries. The second movie is a great example because of her connections with other people. And so she's able to act as a foible, I suppose, to keep things rolling. Yeah. So that's very interesting that was his quote on this type of character. And I think that probably if you go back and look through all the detective characters that people wrote successfully, including Sherlock Holmes, there always had to be another character that he was. It's the same thing with the Doctor from Doctor Who. You have to have somebody that other people, that the people watching or the people reading can identify with. Because if you're trying to hinge the person's ability to connect with the character on this remarkable and almost inhuman character a lot of the time with people like Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple, they might have emotions and they might have feelings, but their entire purpose is to get rid of that for the sake of the science and the sake of the mystery. You have to have another person that the reader can continually connect with to come back. You have the real draw to Sherlock Holmes is not, I mean, yes, it is mystery and it is his mental process, but it's also his relationship with Watson. And you just don't have, even though they try to manufacture a Watson in this one, even though you've got Eugene Pallett there, you don't have enough backstory for him to make it worth, like, getting really interested in him. Yeah, that was a long ramble. And I'm digging back through real quickly just to see if he shows up in the earlier movie. He does. So maybe they tried to do that, but you just don't get enough screen time to make it work.
I thought it was real interesting when I was reading about the Philo Vance character in the book. There is a character called Van Dyne in the book, but he exists. So he's there, and he's occasionally recognized by other people, but he's just there to, like,
record.
Yeah, to be kind of like the eyes and ears of the reader.
Okay, and which is a real common thing at this time. If you read Lost Horizon, they do that. If you read Kipling, he does that a lot, where he'll say, I was traveling, and I'm a reporter, and I met this man that had this incredible adventure, and he sat down, and he told me about it, and this is his story, as he told me. And so it's a way that it's a common theme in this period of writing to have that kind of story structure or that kind of narrative structure. Wow, I sound really intelligent right now. but actually, I think it's we think that's weird now, but at the time, even if you think about, you know, I keep referencing Holmes, Watson did that, you know. He was telling that story. He just happened to be very involved in the cases sometimes, not always. Sometimes he was just relaying like that.
Also would mention that this film was remade in 1937 under Night of Mystery was the title. It starred Grant Richards and Roscoe Carnes and Helen Burgess.
Interesting.
Occasionally you will find it under the Green Murder Case title, but Night of Mystery. So,
good to know.
Yes. If anything sounds familiar to people, but they know they haven't seen this one, maybe right. You've seen that one.
Maybe you've seen the remake. Yeah. I was really hoping you were going to say it was the one with Basil Rathbone because, oh, another one of my favorites. Oh, just, he's so great. Oh, you know. But it is really interesting that you've had both, Nick Charles and Sherlock Holmes have both played Philo Vance.
Oh, yeah.
That's fascinating to me.
What else did you want to talk about with this one?
I think I want to talk about the special effects.
Oh, you were talking about, you did mention some of the camera shots and everything on this. They do some, what I guess is sort of like a crane shot of the roof of the house, which kind of, you would think it was a drone shot. Today it'd be done with a drone. How they did it, I have no idea.
Yeah, and they do it like twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, from one angle, it's clearly a studio. It's very obviously close enough that it's definitely a studio. But then there are, I think, two shots. They're long shots of the house where you see this flat roof section. And I'm scanning through trying to find it right now so that I can kind of describe it. It happens fairly early once in the movie, I want to say. And then it a lot of the final action hinges on the roof. And I think you... there it is. I found it. It shows up in a really weird place. They just real briefly mention the roof, and then they just show like a few seconds, and it's so funny. It's almost like 1960s or 1950s BBC quality, like early 60s BBC quality film. It's so strange to see it. It looks like an anachronism. And they, I think you're right. It has to be a crane shot because, and there are actually people walking around on the roof, but it's a really bad shot. All of the action is happening on this flat part of the roof, but the camera is focused like on the corner of the eaves. And so all you can see is like the people's feet. It's so strange. And so my initial thought was actually, I thought that it was not a crane shot, but a, oh gosh, what do you call it? Like a manual edit, like a manual clip in, which I'm not aware. The only movie I can think of off the top of my head is Star Wars that did it originally.
A matte painting sort of thing?
Thank you. Yeah, like a matte painting is what I thought it was at first.
It could be like a matte painting, or it could be like a forced perspective, like sort of a camera trick. I mean, they could be walking on the studio floor and the camera is mounted on the, you know, in the ceiling.
That would make so much sense in this shot. Oh, you know what? I'm going to rewatch it right now because that is exactly what I would do. That's exactly what I would do to make this work. Because it doesn't look like a real house. And the spot where later somebody takes a tumble off the roof, I don't think I'm giving away too much with that, and falls supposedly into a river. And where the front door is on the house is where the river would be. So it can't be a real house. But I think you're exactly right. I think it's forced perspective. But it was strange enough that it really baffled me. But looking at this, I've frozen it and I'm looking at it. And that's exactly how I would do that if I was going to try and get this to look like that. That's really, thank you for saying forced perspective. That's really been bothering me.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of, it takes me like back to Safety Last with the clock gag, you know, the stunt where it looks like he is 30 stories up and actually he's only about 10 feet.
Yeah.
Because they built that on a platform and then just did that on a roof. So it looks like he's dangling over the street.
Yeah, that must be what they did. And I gotta say, I mean, it's brilliant. It's especially for this time period, it's really well done. If only they had been able to focus more on the action that was going on and less on presumably a model is what they had in front of it. But it's really well lit. It's very convincing. And it's fascinating to me that I shouldn't be so surprised. Obviously, stage productions were doing that kind of thing long before this movie. But that shot specifically really fascinated me. I think that was the only thing in it, aside from the very, very dark quality of some of the... And some of it, it's dark because it's supposed to be. At one point, the sergeant trips over something in the dark.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be he says, I tripped. And he says, what is it? He says, galoshes. And he says, oh, thanks. Like, thanks for finding those because they've been looking for them. Or he says, oh, you're welcome or something like that. But it's meant to be dark. But there are a lot of shots in this that aren't meant to be dark and still are. None of them that are overexposed that I can think of. I can't think of anything that was too bright.
No, absolutely not in this one. And it's so hard to tell is that the way it was filmed? Is it because of the age of the film? We unfortunately will never really know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
what they mix, you know, a shot with the roof, like we were talking about, that is what feels like, as you put it, anachronistic. It feels like it's something that should have happened 50 years later, not in 1929. But early on in there was a scene where the butler is walking through the house and he goes to open a door and his head is cut off in the frame.
Oh.
And I thought, oh man, is this some crappy film that's been cropped down, but then the rest of the film doesn't seem like anything's missing, and everyone else seems to be in frame, so it's just a really weird shot. It's like, and that's the one you went with?
There are a few shots that are like that. I'm looking at one right now where you've got three people standing in frame talking, and literally more than 50% of William Powell's head is just missing. Mm-hmm. But you have down to the ankles and feet of the other people. And so, yeah, I think I would chalk that up to an inexperienced camera operator. I can't imagine that that was a director's decision to say, hey, how about if we do something really weird? Unless this was like a Macy's ad, this framing makes no sense. Unless they're trying to sell clothes from this, it makes no sense at all.
And William Powell's suit provided by... Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? Coco Chanel designed this coat, which is, I think, before Coco Chanel's time even. But yeah, there's definitely some strangeness in this movie. And I think there are... I don't know if it's, well, it's good enough, let's throw it in there. Or if it's, oops, somebody wasn't paying attention, but that's all we've got, so let's throw it in there. But yeah, there's some strangeness to the... Yeah, cinematography.
It may be a case of, you know, the set is only so big, you have to put the camera somewhere, and that's the door that we need to use, and so his head's going to get cut off. I mean,
yeah,
that hallway set is a very long and large set for just a hallway. I mean, the hallway is so big, it has a couch in the middle of it.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of the unsinkable Molly Brown.
Yeah, that's so if you get tired walking from one end to another, you have a nice place to rest.
You can just sit down right here in the hall. It's funny. There's also the end scene, the climax with, we mentioned that somebody gets shucked off the roof. Mm-hmm. And is dangling for quite some time, actually. And that, it's funny, there's a kind of longer shot of that. And there's a whole lot of people running around on set pieces. But yeah, it's interesting. I'd be very curious to have seen the actual set for this movie because, yeah, okay, so pausing it right where somebody takes a tumble off the roof, there's definitely a whole roof set. But I think it's only the roof. I don't think it's, well, no, as it pans down, you get a lot more of the house in there. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not forced perspective. Maybe they really have this whole house built somewhere. It's really strange.
It's very odd. But how they managed to do that roof shot, that crane shot, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
It's such a strange thing.
Maybe it is an existing house. Maybe there is a really big hill.
Yeah. I just don't see how they could have gotten the kind of quality out of it that they got for that shot if they were up on a hill. They could have been on another building.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly a possibility. But yeah, it's interesting. It all looks too much like a set to me to be.
No, it does.
Yeah. So if anybody knows, if anybody's still around from the filming of this, we would love to talk to you.
That is the real mystery of the Green murder case.
Yes. How did they actually film this house?
In the world did they do this shot?
It's not like this is a movie that you go back and watch and rewatch because, oh, the cinematography is so phenomenal. But that one shot was just so strange and jumped out at me so much. Mm-hmm. And I forget what the audio is like over that or those two shots when they do that long shot of the house.
I don't think there is any. There's no dialogue during those shots.
So it feels very much like a scene setting shot, even though it's in the middle of a scene. There's a lot of strange about it, I guess is the point. So I'm going to go with between that and people's heads being, you know, people being decapitated by the film, it does feel like there's some strangeness to this movie, to this direction or to this camera work.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we just chalk it up to the time. I guess we just chalk it up to that particular year. They were cranking out how many hundred movies from Hollywood, and this one just suffered a little bit because of it.
Yeah, and this is done at a time when they're still doing silent versions of the talkie films. There's actually a silent version of this film. I don't know if that exists anymore, but...
That explains the length, though, doesn't it?
No, it keeps it short, yeah. Yeah, it's just it's that early... 20th century. You know, the movie industry is what, only 30 years old?
It's insane to think about that.
Yeah.
You know, and then to think that in turn, we're not even 100 years past this at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We're still only 95 years past this movie. This is in the changes that have happened. I think that's the real charm of this type of movie. The real interesting point of this type of movie is you can go out to any theater today and watch movies that would have been impossible during this period of time. And then you come back and watch this, and yeah, they did what they could with what they had. But it's just amazing to see the changes just in that short period of time.
And, you know, not discounting some of the what they pulled off in some of these films. There are many of these films that look at this shot. We're sitting here scratching our heads over it 95 years later.
Yeah, for new filmmakers, I think it's it should be a requirement for people studying film to go back and watch some of these things, because you really can do, like you said, with forced perspective, there are things that were done in some of these movies that, you know, gosh, if you could figure out how they were done. And it's funny, every once in a while, you and I have come across shots where we go, how did they do that? I'd love for them to be able to redo that, probably more in the practical sense, because we rely so heavily on, you know, on digital and yeah, CG and everything these days. But there is so much you can do with a really low budget if you just, I guess, think outside the box. So it's a lot of fun to see these again.
Yeah, absolutely. So should we go ahead and put a rating on this one?
I think so, but I think it also kind of needs a disclaimer.
Okay.
Because this is just a run-of-the-mill detective film from the 1920s. So if you're coming into it expecting anything very, you know, breathtaking or phenomenal or startling, that's not the genre. The genre is you're supposed to scratch your head. And so I kind of want to approach it from a question of, did you know what the end was going to be? Like, setting out, if, let's say, the first 50% of the movie, did you go, oh, I know who done it? And I think that if you can say, yeah, I knew who done it, then meh, maybe it's not that great of a detective movie. Although some people really like to just feel smug because they knew. But I think for me, that's kind of the question. So we're going to have to rate this with Othels in, is this a movie that we really highly recommend you go watch? But I think we also maybe should talk about it from the, is this a decent whodunit movie too?
Okay. Is it a movie I think you should run out and go watch? No. I think I would probably only give this one a couple Othels, because I don't think it's terribly interesting in the end. And as far as a whodunit, I was kind of getting suckered in by some of the red herrings that they were throwing out, and I thought, well, but as soon as I had my own thoughts, and then as soon as they brought it up as kind of like the red herring, I'm like, oh, well, that's not it then. And I was a little disappointed in the solution. Turns out, and oh, it's all right here in this book. I'm like, what? So there's some of your spoilers there, Catterberg. And so it's like, so our detective solves the mystery by reading a book.
Yeah.
So even on that, I'd still only give it a couple Othels.
Okay. I mean, fair enough.
It started interesting enough. It was pulling me along. It had me wondering who the criminal, you know, or the culprit was. It had me thinking, okay, it's got to be someone in the family, or is it a third party that we haven't seen yet? You know, is it going to be a big twist, and is it going to be the lawyer? It has you thinking and everything for a good portion of the film, until they start bringing up. And the suspects is like, oh, well, maybe it's this person. And you're like, well, then that can't be that person. Oh, maybe it's it. Well, it can't be that person then. And then the solution is brought up very quickly and from a source that you kind of throw your hands up. And go, okay, sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I sit on the Green murder case.
Okay. Fair enough. I also, too, as well, am only going to say, I think this movie, as a movie, let's say two Othels is, I think, fair and maybe bordering on generous, but fair. You know, it's a movie. They finished it. Good job, guys.
Yes.
It didn't just end with an LSD trip. So that's nice. Yes, one of those did that. I think as far as a mystery goes, it actually had me going. Now, I 100% agree with you that we do not get all the information. There are some things that happen. They, you know, figure out the old guy's library. At some point they mentioned that the library was left to the police department.
Yeah.
And they go, well, we should go take a look in this library, right? And I don't understand why the patriarch left his library to the police, and then somehow that's the linchpin, right? Like you said, it was in a book. To me, I felt like they said, oh no, we could see which books had been tampered with. And so I feel like he found the solution because he found books that had been used recently. Fair. So I felt like that was fair enough to say that, yeah, if he had just been reading a random book that he had at home, then I feel like, boo, meh, fail, boring. But to say, you know, here's this locked up thing and this locked up room and, oh, you know, the hinges aren't squeaking. Have they been oiled lately? You know, oh, the galoshes are hidden in this room. Somebody's been in here. It made sense. I would have liked to have seen that introduced earlier in the story to then be like, oh, well, who's been sneaking in and reading all these crime reports or whatever it was. So, yeah, there's definitely... what's the right word for it? Higgledy-piggledy is the wrong word. But there's some kind of some cheating and some winking behind hands, I think, that happens. I totally understand why William Powell would have been disillusioned with this type of character. He doesn't get to do anything. You know, even watching some the phenomenal Poirot mysteries that the BBC has done, even Poirot doesn't really get to do a lot, right? You know, which is lucky because he doesn't like to do a lot. But in this case, you know, if you're an aspiring young actor and you want to have a character that sweeps onto the screen and really captures the action and makes everything interesting happen, you're going to struggle with this. I'm always disappointed with the crazy person solution.
Well, in particular in this one, because
it's
brought up that a person is possibly insane, but this person has gone through the entire film showing no signs of this insanity until the last 3 minutes of the film. Yes. And they're like,
yes. And then they're just a full on basket case.
Yeah.
And so I, again, maybe this is one of those things where, hey, show, don't tell. we're in film, so show this person behaving. Now, you know, and unfortunately in this kind of movie, if you show a person behaving a little bit funny behind, like off away from the rest of the cast, then people feel like they've been cheated because you give away the punchline too soon. Even if you have, you know, the only way to get around that, I guess, is to have 3 or 4 people be crazy.
Right.
I guess. So I'm not happy with the why of this, but as a way that things were executed, I'm very happy with this story. I think if it were anything except that, I think if it had been greed motivated, or if it had been jealousy motivated, oh, especially if the person was jealous of somebody else's secret fiance or husband, I think that would have been fascinating. I would have been like, oh, but you know, we get to see that storyline a little bit later in one of the Thin Man movies, which I highly, highly, highly recommend that you go watch right away, because the Thin Man series, the first Thin Man, for the record, the first Thin Man movie, The Thin Man, in case you guys are wondering, has a rating of 7.9 on IMDb, is the same rating as My Man Godfrey and the same rating as some of the best movies I have ever seen. So yeah, go watch. In particular, in my opinion, the second one is the better one, but the dialogue in those movies stand out. And this movie doesn't have standout dialogue. It doesn't have consistent characterization. It does have, in Christopher's opinion, somewhat slutty dress. It does
risque.
Risque dress. Not my word.
Risque
my word, not
word.
Christopher's.
Risque is the word I should have used early on. And I never said slutty. I said
you never
sexy.
Said slutty. My word, not yours. I admit that 100%. But, you know, it has a few little bits in it that are fun, but it doesn't have all the things that make a movie just like... just where you need to finish it, where you need to watch it. I think that the mystery has it, though. I do think, honestly, that literally, I looked up the timestamp, and the point where I understood what was going on and who was actually the bad guy, like, for sure, was 55 minutes in, and this is a 66-minute movie. And so that's pretty good,
considering
I usually have the murderer pegged within the first 10 minutes. You know, I know that I've mentioned more than once The Mirror Cracked, the BBC made-for-TV movie, that I didn't know what was going on until almost the end. Also, Agatha Christie, highly recommend that one as well. This one actually struck me along for about the same percentage of the movie. So I gotta say that's pretty good. So unfortunately, a too oathful movie. As far as mysteries go, hey, if you're a 1920s mystery aficionado, you should watch this movie, 100%. You should watch probably all the Philo Vance movies. We haven't watched them all, I'm guessing. I'm not stating for a fact. But if you just love murder mysteries, this is at least this character, at least this series is something to add a portion of probably to your repertoire just to have for reference. I think it's worth it. I wish these were on audiobook because I feel like there's something that I could put on and check out for a few minutes and come back and keep up with really easily. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious about them, but I'm not curious enough to sit down and read scanned copies from 1920 over long periods of time, unfortunately.
I actually found mine from the library.
You actually have a hard copy.
I have a hardcover edition.
Wow.
And it is in amazingly good shape for being nearly 100 years old.
That's phenomenal. That's a collector's item. That's a lot of fun. So if you get the chance to grab one of these on eBay and have it and you love murder mysteries, gosh, why not, right?
Right.
Add Philo Vance to your list of sleuths that you've read. If you're only going to watch one William Powell mystery, don't make it this one.
No, yeah, definitely go for The Thin Man. And maybe that is something to say for this film, is where I didn't really care for it, but the mystery did intrigue me enough to want to read a Philo Vance novel. And I went and sought out this particular novel, which I will be reading. So that maybe that does say something there.
Yeah, I was curious too. For the record, just for anybody writing this down, I would go watch The Thin Man first so that you know the characters. But I think the better one is the second one, which is after The Thin Man. Slightly lower rating, interestingly. But in my opinion,
a little less drinking too.
Well, but in my opinion, especially add into it that it has James Stewart, who a very young James Stewart, by the way, which is like so much fun to see. Other people you probably don't know, but standout cast member in that, Alyssa Landy, who plays Selma. I think she's wonderful in it. So, you know, if you want a family murder mystery drama kind of thing, I would go with that one. William Powell is a delight. He's just wonderful. I'm going to marry him when I die. Sorry.
We can have a double wedding when I marry Myrna Loy.
Oh my gosh, I would marry Myrna Loy. She's amazing. She's so incredible. She's wonderful. He's right up there with Basil Rathbone and Danny Kaye and all those other wonderful actors. But his best movie that's such a hard one. I just love him with Myrna Loy. So I would say go with The Thin Man if you're going to watch William Powell. But he did a lot of later stuff in color, too. So if you're I hate black and white movies, go find him in color. He did How to Marry a Millionaire. Oh, so wonderful. Not a main character in it. Well, he is a main character in it, but another great movie to recommend. Anyway, two oathfuls from us on The Green Murder Mystery. And I should stop yammering on about all of my early Hollywood crushes.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this podcast. We will be back in a month with another episode. Lydia, thank you very much for exploring the Green Murder case with me.
I just try to keep it entertaining.
Mission accomplished. I don't know if everyone else laughs while listening, but I know I laugh while editing.
My gosh.
All right, that's going to do it. Thank you for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.